Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
Honey, honey.
Sharon shook her husband, Bill. He sleepily responded.
Honey, wake up, Sharon urged. Someone has to check on the baby, and you said you'd do it, she insisted.
Her groggy husband turned on his side and opened one eye.
Why do we have to check on the baby? I don't hear anything.
Because, Sharon began to push him by his shoulder, it's been 2 hours, and he hasn't made a peep. You need to see if he's okay.
Bill slowly hauled himself out of bed and shuffled toward the doorway.
How long are we going to have this schedule?
Shh, Sharon whispered loudly. You don't want to wake him.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about newborns? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has years of experience with young children and experience with the media as well. Dr. Russell C. Libby is currently chief of the general pediatrics section at Inova Fairfax Hospital for Children. He's founder, president, and medical director of Virginia Pediatric Group in Northern Virginia and co-founder of the American Pediatric Consultants Incorporated. He's also an instructor and clinical professor at several medical schools in the Washington area and has been recognized for his dedication to pediatric medicine with numerous awards and honors. He hosts 2 monthly healthcare-focused television programs and has hosted a weekly medical information and opinion call-in radio show as well. Dr. Libby's the father of 3 girls, 18, 22, and 26. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Libby.
Thank you, Linda. It's a real pleasure to be here.
What would you say is our biggest misconception about newborns?
Well, I think it really depends on the person. Misconceptions, well, I would say that probably most people think that babies are the most fragile little organisms that they could be. And the term baby coming out has an incredible degree of development already present and incredible resilience. These babies are programmed and ready to take off and start living.
Parents of newborns are nearly always worried about them. Can you give us some things we don't need to worry about?
Well, I would say that the most important indicator of how healthy your baby will likely be come time to deliver is really how healthy you were through the pregnancy. I think that nowadays we are able to really monitor how moms progress through their pregnancy, whether it be simple things like their general state of health and exposure to infections, or weight gain and the possibility of developing diabetes. But even beyond that, now we have ultrasound testing of the babies, which is where you can get an image of the baby's internal organs and their growth and development through mom's skin while the baby's in utero. You can get remarkable detail. You can look at the brain. You can identify if there are certain structural abnormalities of the heart. You can look at the kidneys. You can look at all the organs that are crucial and significant and in the past would often be a surprise if there was a problem coming out. So I'd say that we have now in prenatal care an incredible advancement relative to knowing that we're going to have a healthy baby when they come out. Years ago, it wasn't so. It was often tragic in that event. Now we have genetic testing where you can have some sense of some of the genetic abnormalities like Down syndrome, which is a more common and livable kind of outcome. But there are a number that are potentially fatal and that we need to know about prior to delivery in some situations. As women get older, as fathers are older, we find that that potential for genetic abnormalities increases, and you'll find that more people will get their amniotic fluid or chorionic villus sampling done, and you will look at the genetic profile when they are still early in the pregnancy. Nonetheless, you have many prenatal services, and of course, that's the thrust of most public programs out there, are to get young mothers who don't necessarily have regular medical care into some prenatal program so that they can have a healthier pregnancy and have a better outcome.
You said chorionic villus sampling. That's a new one to me. Can you explain what that is?
Chorionic villus sampling is basically an alternative to amniocentesis. It can be done a little bit earlier in the pregnancy. There have been trends back and forth. Chorionic villus sampling requires an entry through the internal perspective rather than a needle through the belly. And they just take a little sample of the chorionic villi, which are basically that part of the placenta that borders on where the baby is. There's a small risk of bleeding, but typically it's pretty competently accomplished. And different docs do different testing. There are different formats that people will go through. But once again, the issue here being that you can do some prenatal testing if there is some risk, if you have some risk factors that might dictate that would be a sensible thing to do.
What kinds of testing do young people get or young couples get if they're considering becoming pregnant and they want to make sure about, you said there was some counseling about genetic testing?
Well, you have to consider how we are now evolving our medical records. And I'd say that as this next generation comes up, they're going to be in a little bit better shape to be able to look back and say, I know what killed Uncle Ted. I know why that relative of mine never quite did so well in school or seemed to have some social issues and other kinds of problems. We have the potential now through personal health records, PHRs as they call them, to start to record all this information and to be able to develop a true family tree rather than one that's just little boxes with names in them, to actually have some medical and genetic background on ourselves and what's coming up through it. So that's one thing you will start to see in the generation coming up and those expectant parents. They may have a lot more information on the kinds of diseases that people have and the risks that they might run. But in terms of what most parents will check, there are some defined tests that certain people will take. If you are African American, you'll have a sickle cell screen. Now we're basically doing that on all newborns so that most people growing up will know if they have a trait, which means that you have one gene when you need two to have real disease, which means that both parents have to have a trait to give that child disease. Now we have some sense of, okay, it may not be wise when you both have this trait to have a baby, or if you do, you need to understand what the consequences are. We can give you that kind of counseling. On the other hand, Jews may be testing for Tay-Sachs genes. That's a metabolic disease that affects the nervous system in young kids and will ultimately result in their demise somewhere in the first or second year. Tough stuff and things that people can avoid having to encounter and endure if they have some advanced knowledge. Sexually transmitted diseases, some of them are significant and can affect baby. They can affect the pregnancy. We can do some pre-testing and pre-treatment for some of those as well. So there are a number of things, hepatitis B, group B strep. They're all things that we now screen for. We make sure we know what's going on in the parents before we take them into the hospital because it can affect how we treat the baby when they're born.
We talk about full-term newborns, which you were talking about. What's full-term? Is there a range being considered full term?
Well, you have basically considered full term, really solidly full term, is 38 weeks to 41 weeks gestation. You could say that 36 to 7 weeks would be late preterm, and there's some special qualities that we think about with those babies. And you could think those over 41 weeks, as in 41 to 42, because typically they don't go much further than that, are post term. But those regular term babies, basically 38 to 40 weeks, 41 weeks, are generally where we see them most mature and most developmentally excellent.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on newborns.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Russell Libby about newborns.
What behaviors are normal for newborns?
Well, I would say that most babies, when they're born, are going to come out and still surprise a parent. And for me, one of the great joys is to see a baby shortly after birth, not only to feel the energy and the outcome of all this work and energy and all this expectation from the parents, but to be able to look at a baby and see an incredible reproduction of so many of those incredible organs and features that we know and come and learn and expect to see in a human. And you see a beautiful baby, and you can examine that baby, you can see the arrangements in the right place, and it's a fascinating thing to see. When we see a baby come out, typically, obviously, they're crying, in a delivery room, which is where most babies are delivered in a low-risk situation. Basically, they'll be suctioned out. They'll suction out all the fluid, the amniotic fluid that the baby's been sitting in. They've been swallowing, and their respiratory tract and their mouth and their intestines are all full of that, along with the residual of the things they've been digesting from that fluid over the period of months that they've been developing. First thing we do is suction out the mouth and the nose, and that's so that they minimize the amount of fluid that they inhale when they take those first breaths. Sometimes babies are born after enduring some stress close to the time of delivery. Sometimes that may induce them to have a first bowel movement. And when that happens, that can happen before they are born in that amniotic fluid. They call that meconium staining, that first bowel movement of babies, the substance that's basically made up of dead cells that they continue to swallow as they suck on their hands, and they practice these swallowing movements so that when they come out, they are ready to go right at the breast or whatever form of feeding you're going to provide for them. They're going to be swallowing these things, making this stool in utero, and sometimes it gets stressed, it comes out, it gets into the fluid, and it is an irritating substance if it gets into the lungs. So then it's a very crucial issue to suction out that baby as best you can before they take that first breath. So that's the first measure coming out that people are going to make sure. They will assess a baby after being born for something they call the Apgar scores. The Apgar scores are basically a 5-component assessment of certain things that a baby might demonstrate at birth, and especially a term baby. It's going to be their general muscle tone. Are they flexioned and tight and apparently very responsive to their environment? Do they have a reasonable heart rate? And we measure those heart rates according to the number of beats per minute. Do they have a response when you irritate their respiratory tract? You put a little catheter towards their nose, and will they sneeze? Will they try to breathe? What is their respiratory effort like? And their appearance, their color. Typically, babies are not born all bright pink and well oxygenated. Sometimes they're born with a fairly blue hue, and sometimes it's their hands and feet are just blue. And in fact, these scores, as we call them, Apgars, seem to be very important to people. They are predictors of what the outcome of that delivery will be. They're done at 1 minute and at 5 minutes. We have basically 0 to 2, 0 being no score for that, and 2 being a normal or perfect score. Rare that we get kids that are 10 and 10. Like I said, most of them are going to have at least at 1 and likely at 5 minutes a couple of points off, either for respiratory effort or for tone or for their color, which is going to be most common. But at 5 minutes, we like to see them above 7. So babies come out, they have a couple of minutes of being very alert that first hour. They seem to be looking around the world. They seem to want to have some sense of what's going on around them, but in a very kind of obscure way, one that you can't quite figure out. They are responsive, but not necessarily as you might expect an older child to be. They are remarkable in that first hour, and they'll be very quiet generally. It's a remarkable time, and a remarkable time to see a baby and to see a family as they start to acknowledge and receive and feel the presence of their child out here in the real world.
What abilities do newborns come with to help them understand the world? You know, we've been hearing about sight back and forth. They don't see it all. They see a little bit. They only see black and white. So there must be a whole raft of things they come with to help them out.
Well, one of the things that people will often see is their baby comes out with this sort of wrinkled up face, looking almost like Mr. Magoo. I know I'm dating myself. But we also know Mr. Magoo couldn't see very well. And in fact, their vision as they come out is somewhere around 2400, which would make them quite blind from a legal perspective. Certainly wouldn't want them driving.
They couldn't reach the pedals,
no, but all the phone books in the world won't do it. But nonetheless, what happens is that they have a fair distribution of the nerves in the eye that allow them to see black and white and just a little semblance of color, mostly shades and shapes, and from about 5 to 12 inches in front of them. So they can focus in on things, and in fact, a parent will hold a baby in front of them close to their face, and you will find a baby will focus down right onto your eyes. It's a remarkable thing that they will look at your eyes instinctively. So their vision is thus when they're born. It's not particularly distinct, but it is there, and they start to assimilate images in their mind. They can hear quite well. And certainly they don't know what to think of what they hear because they haven't created those associations yet. So typically they will startle. They will sometimes cry, sometimes they won't. But it's not something that is quite the same as how we perceive what we hear. But they do hear quite well at birth. And in fact, we do test hearing in the first couple of days after birth to make sure that they aren't deaf, because we do know that early intervention with kids who have diminished hearing is a very important process for their future development, both social, language, and overall development. So it's an important test that we do on all newborns in most states. I believe that pretty much every state now will mandate that the state provide a hearing screen on those babies. Smell, taste, they exist. We don't know how perceptive they are of what those senses do for them. They do feel. They have touch receptors. They respond to caresses. They respond to sound. They soothe with the voices that they've heard in utero. They recognize mom's voice. They recognize dad's voice. Always good to talk to your baby, not to raise your voice when they're in utero, and to really get them comfortable and used to the sound of your soothing voice.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion with Dr. Russell Libby.
For an audio CD of any Parents Perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Russell Libby about newborns.
Are there certain problems that parents should be alert for besides being totally stressed out about everything?
Well, parents will make their problems. And it's also interesting to me, especially with first babies, the level of stress expectation and anticipation of things going wrong is so much higher than with subsequent kids. And most of it has to do with the fact, once again, that they don't realize that babies have a pretty established and well-developed set repertoire of operational capabilities and that they're pretty tough and resilient. The fact that babies cry, when I listen to a baby cry, when I listen to my own babies cry, I realize that this was just a yell for, wow, I'm here, I'm alive, I'm fine, I'm great, I'm breathing, I'm crying, I'm responding. This is my only way of interacting with my environment. It's an instinctive outburst of energy and expression. It's not necessarily always a painful indicator. It's not always that I'm upset and this is terrible, make sure I'm corrected and feel better. But most first parents will take every cry as an indication that they are doing something wrong, that they have to quiet and calm that baby for that purpose. A lot of times babies just discharge a certain amount of energy with a cry. It lasts a minute or two, and then they're remarkably calm thereafter. So it's learning how to read and understand how that goes on. The kinds of things that we see in the first week of life, of course, that are most crucial are going to be related to nutrition. And certainly one of the issues being we do encourage all moms to breastfeed. It's the best, most natural and nutritionally, immunologically, and developmentally probably the best way to feed your baby if you can. Some women have a hard time. Some aren't in the situation where it is feasible, and they may use bottle feeding, which would mean you use a formula. And formulas certainly are formulated based upon the nutritional composition of breast milk. And they are adequate. But if you can breastfeed, you should. And even if it's only partial, you got to give it as much as you can for as long as you can, at least through that first year of life, if it's possible. Nonetheless, those first few days of life, babies are born, let's say a term baby might be 7 or 8 pounds. In the first day of life, they have a lot of tissue fluid. We call that edema. They mobilize that. It keeps their blood volume up. It lets their kidneys work. They make their urine from it. They use that up. They have meconium, as we had talked about, that fetal stool that they pass. It takes 2 or 3 good old stools. It looks like tar. People are amazed as what this stuff is and how it comes out that way. But basically, the body has this substance in it to carry it through the first couple of days. Now, breast milk will usually take 2 to 4 days to start to get mobilized with frequent nursing attempts, or at least getting the baby to breast 8 to 10 times a day. By the 3rd to 5th day, most moms are engorged and starting to feel that they have milk production. It may still take 5 full days before they're actually getting a good flow. So there is a transition from what they have there on board when they're born to what they aren't getting yet from the breast milk, and they can get dehydrated. And that can cause a lot of metabolic issues, meaning that they can have an alteration in their body chemistry in a way that can make them look sick or make them less energetic to feed. It also can affect something we call the concentration of bilirubin, which is a yellow pigment jaundice that babies sometimes get, and actually elevate it beyond what it might normally be and create more of a risk problem for them. So I would say nutrition is number one in terms of those risks that parents need to be aware of coming out, understanding that you want to see urine output beyond that first day. You want to see it continue at least a little semblance of urine every 6 hours. It doesn't have to be a saturated diaper, but some. And some people who may have a hard time telling with the diapers that we use today, which have so much absorptive capacity, they may put a Kleenex or something in front of the urinary outlet and see if that's a good index for them when they get wet. But stool, a couple stools a day, urine every 6 to 8 hours minimum is what you need getting through this transition to where mom has her breast milk flowing.
What happens if that isn't the case? In other words, parents are worried now they have to worry about their baby being dehydrated. And so what is generally recommended if that's the case?
Well, the goal being getting the baby to breast, there is a catch-22, as we say in the situation. If you don't get frequent breast stimulation, you won't get the volume of milk evolving that you need to feed the baby. So we like you to get at least 8 and preferably 10 and even 12 nursing opportunities a day. If you can get both breasts in, great. If it's one, that's okay too. We always alternate the one we start with so that you get equal stimulation. Each breast is a separate milk factory. They have a separate staff and a separate stimulating mechanism. Certainly the hormones will help, but nonetheless, you have to do them both to get them both to make adequate amounts of milk to be able to use either breast in a feed. Nonetheless, we would then offer supplements, and oftentimes, at least at hospitals and in most communities, there are lactation specialists. These are consultants who have taken certifying courses in lactation advice, and they will often come to your house, or you can come to some kind of center where they might be working with you. They can provide you with pumps, electric pumps preferred over hand pumps. Just by the way, don't bother buying a hand pump. If you're thinking about a pump, you're going to find an electric pump is a much more effective mechanism. And they can help you get through this period of time. But in fact, there are situations where babies just aren't getting enough milk and they don't have the energy to suck anymore. And we end up having to put IVs in them and hydrate them, give them the sugar and other nutrients they need until they can get that sucking coordinated and evolved. And that's where you see some of these premature babies have a hard time. Those, as I was saying, the late preterm. And a lot of these late preterms, well, it was 36 weeks, this baby's breathing fine, doesn't need any oxygen, is adapting to room temperature okay, seems to have a pretty good suck. But at 36, 37, 37 and a half weeks, 35 weeks, they can look really normal, they can look very mature, they can be big premature babies, but they don't have all the machinery that's going to support them through the next few days quite as adequately as those term babies. So you got to be careful.
What are some of the differences to expect of a newborn who's premature?
Well, it certainly depends on the degree of prematurity and the reason why they were delivered early. Obviously, in the best of situations, you have some anticipation. There are things we do to prepare babies who are going to be delivered prematurely. When we have a mom who's generally, we have to say 22 weeks is probably at the early edge of anything that could be close to viable, and that would be a very, very high-risk situation. 24 to 26 is more ordinarily the more, let's say, anticipatory age that you would like if you had to deliver very early. But most babies, we can get mom to bed rest. We can give them certain medicines that slow down their contractions if they're having premature contractions. And we can get them to last a few more weeks, another month, another 2 months, whatever it might be. The longer we can make it last, the better. But if we see it coming, We can provide certain medicines to mom that will help the baby be more adept and ready for the external environment, in particular with their lungs, which basically are not really ready to breathe air the way we expect to breathe air until about 35 weeks.
Well, this is obviously a topic of great interest to so many of us, and it's a shame we can't go on, but we have time constraints. So before we close, what resources would you suggest to our listeners who want to follow up on some of the issues we've been discussing?
I think that the American Academy of Pediatrics, www.aap.org, has a lot of very good parent and professional information. There are some organizations that care about kids. NEMORS, NEMORS.org, is the DuPont Hospital in Wilmington, but they have an excellent website with all kinds of information sort of targeted at different ages, parents, adolescents, and even for children, so you can get a lot of useful information on children there as well. Most of the universities with children's centers will have nice websites as well. I would suggest going to the public library. If you're thinking about baby books, people always ask, and now since their whole bookstore is full of them, it's not just Dr. Spock, probably going in there for an hour or two and sitting and looking through some of those books in a public library will help you get the information you need.
Well, you have certainly been a wonderful source of information for all of us. So, Dr. Russell Libby, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 373 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from our listeners. Our sound engineer is Mike Belasia. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.